This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, a look at all that water in California. And we'll talk about the role of farmers in conservation. But first, a trip back in time, say maybe 4.5 billion years ago. The moon has just been split off from the Earth, and our planet, think magma oceans. Eventually, those oceans begin to cool and a solid crust forms on the Earth's surface, sort of like a cooling custard. But what happened next? Geologists say in the journal Nature that in the early days of Earth, there may not have been plate tectonics, you know, moving pieces of crust, but perhaps just one big plate, sort of like an eggshell covering the whole world. Joining me to talk about that and how that would have worked is one of the authors of that report, Michael Brown. He's professor of geology, University of Maryland in College Park. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon, Ira.
A single shell like an eggshell, how does that idea different than what we think now? Generally accepted idea.
Well, the difference is that at present, the Earth's outer shell is broken up into about 10 large and 6 small plates. We call them plates because they're largely internally rigid, so they can move relatively one with respect to the other. For example, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, they move apart, creating an underwater mountain range called the Mid-Ocean Ridge. In California, along the San Andreas Fault, one plate moves past the other sideways. We call that a transform fault or a transcurrent fault. And under the Pacific Ring of Fire, the Pacific Ocean and the Nazca Ocean off of South America are both being pushed underneath the continental edge down back into the mantle. That's a converging margin where we destroy oceanic material. Mm-hmm. So we have this ability to create new material at mid-ocean ridges and destroy it at the subduction zones around the Pacific Ring of Fire. That's the way the Earth works at present, but the Earth's mantle underneath the crust was hotter in the past. And if it was hotter, it may not have behaved the same way.
So you're saying that then back then that it was a solid crust underwater because we had all those oceans and one big plate, not the multiple plates that we have.
That's correct. I think that is probably the global geodynamic regime throughout the Archean, which is the period of Earth history from 4 billion years ago to 2.5 billion years ago. It's a little difficult to calculate exactly how hot the interior of the Earth would have been at the end of the magma ocean. The upper mantle, the upper part of the material beneath us, may have been 100 or 150 degrees warmer than the present day, and that mantle would have continued to get hotter until about 3 billion years ago. And then since that time, since maybe 3 billion years ago, it's been cooling down to the present day, and at that maximum, it could have been 250 or 300 degrees warmer. If the material underneath us is warmer, as it rises up in response to convective motions, it produces a higher percentage, a higher volume of melt, and that melt has a more magnesium-rich, less silicic composition. It's different than the ocean basins at the present day.
And so is that what starts to form all the different plates? You have different kinds of minerals?
No, I think what that does, you have to imagine a world where there are many more volcanoes distributed across the world, across the globe, than we see at present. We have occasional volcanoes at present. You can think of Hawaii in the middle of the Pacific. You can think of Iceland. And we have volcanoes at plate boundaries, like around the Pacific Ring of Fire. But this world would have had the possibility for volcanism anywhere across the surface. It would have had the possibility of volcanism being generated by upwellings in the upper mantle, as well as these larger, what we call plumes, that are generated at the core mantle boundary. There's these big tubes of hot magma that come up through 2,900 kilometers of Earth's mantle.
So how do we get from the solid crust into all the plates? What is the progression there?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. I can give you a couple of possibilities that we're investigating. One possibility is that these large plumes, these large tubes of hotter material that come generated from the core mantle boundary, that these are able to produce so much magmatism at the surface that they push this outer shell down sufficiently that it starts to sink under its own weight. This would generate a local, on the scale of something like the Pacific Ocean perhaps, but a local area of subduction. And it may be that with enough of these plumes in the late part of the Archean, that we can generate a globally linked network of plate boundaries. An alternative would be that simply through what we might call wear and tear, that this shell begins to get weaker in certain linear zones. And as it begins to weaken in certain linear zones, those linear zones start to link up. So we have a network of weaknesses in this outer shell that eventually are able to move apart as magmatism forces them apart, and some move together. And again, we eventually generate a globally linked network of plate boundaries.
Huh. Do we have any rock formations today that date all the way back to that time?
The oldest rocks on the planet, and there's very little real estate left of that time, are in the western part of Canada, the Acastonices, in southwest Greenland, and then in the East Pilbara terrain that we studied in the Barberton Mountain land in South Africa. And these go back to 4 billion years. We have a very limited record of what happened before 4 billion years. In that first 500 million years, we have some remnant minerals called zircons that are found in sedimentary rocks in Western Australia.
Do the rocks tell the story themselves? These old rocks have evidence of, you know, the solid crust, or is that very difficult to find?
The oldest rocks have evidence of what we call the first continental crust. This is the evolved material that's generated by multiple episodes of distillation through either crystallization of liquids or remelting of material to generate something that has a more silica-rich composition and that will float relative to the ocean basins as we have at present. The continents make up about a third of the surface of the globe, and that's the land area. And it's the land area because that material that comprises the continents is more silicic, it's less dense, and it therefore is able to sit above the mantle rather than go back into the mantle under normal circumstances.
So you basically
Whereas
have
the ocean basins are heavier, and therefore they're shallow, they form seas, they're underwater.
Now that explains it. That's why the land is up and the oceans are down. The stuff that's the bottom
that's
of the oceans are down.
They're different compositions, and therefore they sit at different levels on the surface of the Earth.
Now you talked about a hot magma Earth. I mean, how can water be covering the Earth when the Earth is so hot?
Well, water covers volcanoes in the Pacific. If you think of the Izu Bonin Marianas volcanic chain, it's mostly underwater.
Yeah.
We have volcanic peaks peaking through the water surface, and we have lavas that are erupted there. Hawaii stands up above the surface of the water quite a way. But if we took the entire Pacific Ocean away, this would be the largest mountain on Earth.
Hmm. And how do you know that all this water was around there at the beginning of that shell time?
Because we have information from geochemistry that tells us that the surface of the Earth could not have been more than perhaps 100 degrees Celsius warmer than the present day. And we have evidence recorded in these zircons that I mentioned earlier, this mineralogical record of the first 500 million years of Earth's history, that show that there must have been surface water.
So we
have a cool environment at the surface.
I see the picture. So what's the controversy here? What's the alternative theory that you're pushing against?
Well, the alternative would be that it's business as usual, that the Earth has behaved in a plate tectonic manner all the way back to soon after 4.5 billion years ago. In other words, this outer shell that would have formed first of all as the magma ocean crystallized after the moon-forming impact would have very soon developed into a network of spreading, moving apart, converging, moving together, and moving sideways plate boundaries that would have enabled that shell to, if you like, crack into a number of plates. Those plates might have been smaller than the present day, in which case there would have been more of them. They may have moved faster or slower. There may have been differences. But the argument would be that we've had a plate tectonic regime since very early on in Earth history. And one of the arguments in favor of that is a particular fingerprint in the chemistry of igneous rocks. And I think one of the things our paper does is demonstrate that this chemical fingerprinting is not a unique signature of a particular tectonic environment. And we have to be more careful how we identify things when we go way back in time.
So how do you go about providing, you know, new evidence or convincing people that your model is better than the old one?
Well, I mean, the community as a whole does this. This is how science works. We have so little rock available back that far in time that we have to use the limited information we have from those rocks and a variety of modeling techniques. We're able to model the stability of minerals at particular pressures and temperatures for particular compositions of rocks, and we're able to predict what the melt compositions would be and what their chemistry could be, and we can compare these with the rocks that we actually have from that past era. And so it's a community effort to try and understand this. I think at the moment there's a consensus in favor of something like plate tectonics starting 3 billion years ago, perhaps. I don't mean by that that there's 98% of us believe that, but probably more than half of the geologists interested in this topic would subscribe to that view at the moment. And that may change with time. This is the way we work. We try to prove ourselves wrong. We can't prove ourselves right.
So at least you get the conversation going, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And if we didn't have disagreements, we wouldn't advance science. If we all agreed, there'd be no fun in the game.
Well, everybody thinks that scientists know everything. You know, one of the most surprising things to people who listen to Science Friday is hearing scientists disagree with one another, but it's actually very informative.
And it's fun.
This is fun. Okay. Mike Brown, Professor of Geology, University of Maryland, College Park. We'll have you back for some more fun sometime. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed it. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the farmers on the front lines of conservation. Now, farmers are basically deciding to farm differently and what that means for carbon footprint. And for farmers, they like to call themselves environmentalists, but what they actually do really does help the environment. We'll talk with some farmers, and hopefully you're on the line. If you're a farmer, give us a call. Our number 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. We've had farmers out on their combines and tractors calling us in the past. We hope to get some more. You can also tweet us out there at SciFry, 844-724-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When you think of an environmentalist, who comes to mind? Well, maybe someone who buys organic, a foodie who eats locally, maybe a Prius driver trying to reduce her footprint. They're all part of a carbon-conscious class that is becoming more mainstream. But there are folks on the front lines quietly going on about their conservation work. They may not even call themselves environmentalists, but they see conservation from the ground up, literally. It's the basis for their livelihood. They are the modern farmers. And one of my next guests writes, as these productive landscapes grow increasingly precarious, overgrazed, overtilled, overfished, it is the families who run the tractors and the barges and the fishing boats who are stepping up to save them. And their farming methods are helping to keep tons of greenhouse gas CO2 trapped in the soil and keep the land more fertile for the future. How are they doing it? That's what we're going to be talking about. Also, if you are a farmer, someone who works in the ag business, give us a call, 844-724-8255, or if you just want to talk about farming in general, let me introduce my guests. Miriam Horn is the author of the book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. She joins us here in IQNY Studios. Good to see you. Thank you for stopping by.
Thank you.
Doug Palin is a farmer and rancher from Glen Elder, Kansas. He's also a founding board member of the organization No Till on the Plains. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Doug, your farm has been in your family for four generations. You started this no-till method when you took it over. What made you decide to make that switch?
Yeah, I'm the fourth generation here where we are in Kansas, and after I graduated from college back in 1993, I returned to the family farm to take over management and had some exposure to no-till prior to that, and it looked like a good system to embark on and one that would afford a young producer a lot of opportunities, and so it's been a great journey.
Describe for our listeners what no-till means.
Primarily, the first thing people think of is certainly the lack of tillage. So we've discontinued doing tillage, but it's so much more than that, where we're doing crop rotations and we're rotating crops on different fields every year and really trying to understand the soil and the biology of the soil.
So you don't plow up the field? How else then do you plant your seeds?
Yeah, so actually we're able to just seed directly into the residues or the crop stubbles that remain on the surface, that are now protecting the soil from wind and water erosion and helping to conserve the water that does fall, particularly that's in moisture-limiting climates like the Central Plains where I farm.
So, you know what, when we go out to farm, I was in Georgia, in the farmland in Georgia last couple weeks ago, in Texas, wherever you go, you see these giant acreage just open, the soil's exposed. You're not leaving your soil exposed like that, are you?
Right, yeah, no. So what we're constantly trying to do is mimic the native system or the natural system where there's always something growing, and we try and do that even with the annual crops that we can produce for the consumers, and yet leave a cover on the soil and to protect the soil. So yeah, always trying to armor the soil. We often talk about is to protect it with the residues on the surface.
Mm-hmm. Miriam, one of the most important aspects of farming is the health of the soil. And in your book, you say soil is also one of our most vulnerable and endangered resources. It is effectively non-renewable. What do you mean by that?
Well, soil actually takes about 500 years to create a single inch. It's a mix of eroded rock and organic matter. And so when you lose it, as we still are losing in the U.S. close to 2 billion tons of topsoil every year in some parts of the country, that's the equivalent of about a foot or more of topsoil gone. And that's thousands and thousands and thousands of years to replenish that really most critical ecosystem we have on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Doug, what differences have you noticed in terms of productivity or the soil health for your farm since you've gone to this no-till?
Yeah, well, we've over the almost 25 years now, I guess, that I've been doing it, we always monitor the soil's health both chemically with the nutrients and monitor its organic matter. And so those numbers have continued to climb, particularly the organic matter, which is such an integral function or part of the soil. And so, yeah, we just continue to see the soil's texture continue to get better. And again, its organic matter continue to rise, and it just continues to perform even better than it did.
You know, we talk a lot on Science Friday about the human microbiome, the microbiome that's in our bodies, in our gut. But there is a microbiome, Miriam, in the soil, is there not, that gets disrupted when you plow it up?
Absolutely. It's a third of Earth's organisms live in the soil, and they perform these critical functions. They sustain photosynthesis, which is where we get all our food and all our air. They protect plants and humans from disease. They hold the soil together. They hold nutrients and carbon in the soil. They conduct a kind of barter economy in plants where they bring them those nutrients. But if you scramble the soil with a plow, if you twist through it, I liken it to a tornado where you scramble these symbiotic communities, you collapse the homes that they live in, and so you overfeed them really with the residues, and so you allow a kind of explosion of bacteria at the expense of fungi, and the bacteria eat up all the organic matter and respire it out as carbon dioxide. So you rob the soil of this vital nutrient and you add it to the atmosphere where it adds to climate change.
Yeah, and the soil actually is a sink for carbon dioxide, isn't it? It holds it in.
It is. It's the second biggest repository of carbon on the planet. It has twice as much as the atmosphere and every plant combined. And if you farm well, if you leave the soil undisturbed and you keep it protected in these ways and you care for your microbiome, you can start rebuilding that carbon back. It was pretty much stripped out by all the generations of plowing that followed on homesteading, but this group of farmers that Doug is part of are seeing the carbon levels in their soil building back up toward native prairie levels.
Let's go to the phones to Grinnell, Iowa. Hi, welcome. You're on Science Friday.
Hello, yes. My husband and I do livestock production, and we do a thing called mob grazing, and it's designed to replicate what the buffalo did. And so we're increasing our organic matter and its capacity to hold carbon through moving our cattle every day or every other day in intensive paddocks. And then we're trying to do that part, but it is very difficult to, we also raise crops, so it is difficult. I'd like to make a distinction between plowing and other forms of disturbance. So there is a continuum of disturbance practices, and not all are as bad as, you know, it's a difficult and nuanced problem.
Thank you, Doug. You also sort of do that you also have animals on your farm.
Yeah. I also have a cow herd, and we raise cows and calves, and I integrate that very much into my cropping system. So, on some of the lands that are a bit more marginal, or even across all the fields, we grow on occasion crops that are grazed. Grazed in that system, and I've actually seen, interestingly enough, we've seen a lot of grain producers through the Midwest who've actually reintroduced cattle back into the croplands, and I think that's a key component of the natural system where we have livestock, and so we're actually seeing a trend back to that. And as the lady described there, where they're doing some mob grazing and some things, those are kind of interesting and functional in the system.
Do you use herbicides on your crops? Do you think you're using less than if you would have tilled the area?
Yeah, we still continue to use in our system some crop protection products when we don't have. I guess our first line of defense is always the natural system, so we're always trying to see what we can do with cultural practices, and that's crop rotation and sanitation and all those things. And when we can't accomplish what we need there, sometimes we use crop protection products to kind of nudge the system along, to help it along. And as the word describes, they're there to protect the health of the crop that we're growing, which is the food that we're producing.
I also understand that you don't irrigate your farm.
Yeah, I don't have, in my area, everything's done in dry land. We don't have irrigation or natural water surface or subsurface to do, so everything I get is what Mother Nature gives me, so that's what we work with, and we get along well.
You get along well. That's also, Miriam, you know, this is working out for the farmers.
Yes, it's got tremendous benefits for the farmers. Kansas has been dealing with incredibly extreme weather for the last number of years, swinging from the hottest, deepest droughts it's in recorded history to these unseasonal freezes and snowstorms, and then these torrential rains. And the wheat yields in general have been really volatile in line with that, but the no-till farmers have seen much steadier and high yields. Their soil is much better at capturing water. It stays very porous, so the water permeates very deep in the soil, and then it's much better at holding the water. There isn't nearly as much evaporation or water loss, and so they're much more resilient to these extremes of weather. And as Doug said, they often need far fewer inputs. They have to make many fewer tractor passes, which saves a lot on time and diesel. But they also frequently add much less nitrogen because the crop rotations are doing that work. Nature is providing the nitrogen that they need.
I have a tweet from Sarah saying, calling practices like no-till burgeoning conservation makes me pretty annoyed, because my family has been doing those things for decades, as have other farmers around us. Let me go to a farmer in Lovettsville, Virginia. Chris, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So I was excited when I heard you all introduce the topic and talk about no-till farming, because I work for the Soil and Water Conservation District here, and I also have a hay operation of my own. And I deal with a lot of sort of new farmers, you know, people buying a little bit of acreage and looking to farm. And there's so much when they think about conservation, a lot of them are thinking, well, I want to farm organically, or I don't want to use sprays. And one thing that I think is important to think about is, well, you know, there are a lot of issues surrounding using herbicides and pesticides. Using no-till farming and using conservation practices like that is solving one of the big issues we have. We think back to the Dust Bowl, we think about soil loss. And I think people get so myopic about focusing on, well, I don't want to eat GMOs, or I don't want to eat anything that's been sprayed. And that, you know, we really need to look at the fact that there are a lot of conservation practices that are aided by the use of some of these chemicals, and that allow us to, maintain that soil health. So it's not perfect, but if we go back to the way we farmed in the 40s and 50s, our conservation won't be benefited there. It might actually be reduced.
Thanks for your call. Doug, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I think he's right. I think we need to look at those things. Again, as we look at an increasing population in the world, we have people to feed, and you know, more so from a nutrient standpoint, I think people need to understand that out here in the fields where we grow the food, it needs fertilizer. It needs fertilizer to put on, which is fine. So we grow it and we capture it and we put it in trains to ship to where the people are in the cities, and that takes those nutrients with it. You know, a 100-car train of soybeans such has 400,000 pounds of phosphorus that goes to the cities, and that's fine. But if we don't identify a way to bring that nutrient back, whether it's sewer sludge or whatever, I think people need to understand that we're shipping that out and we have to replace it with something. And so what we're doing then is with commercial fertilizer here to replace mm-hmm. that until we figure out a way to kind of close that loop or close that system.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Doug Palin, farmer and rancher from Glen Elder, Kansas. He's a board member, founding board member of No Till on the Plains. Miriam Horn, author of Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. And you talk about in your book, you talk not just about farming the land, or you talk about farming and shrimpers in Louisiana.
Right.
What are they doing?
So I found all these wonderful characters through my work through Environmental Defense Fund. And one of the big projects we're involved in is the effort to restore the Mississippi River Delta. The Mississippi has been re-engineered for more than a century. And the consequence of building levees all the way down that river was that it starved its own delta. The wetlands that it had built began to dissolve into the Gulf of Mexico, and Louisiana has lost 2,000 square miles of really critical land, critical for fisheries and birds and critical for protection for people and oil and gas infrastructure. So the shrimper that I write about, and also there, I have a CEO of a barge company, and they're both involved in an effort to allow the Mississippi again to begin rebuilding its wetlands by releasing it from that straitjacket of levees.
Interesting. Doug, the Farm Bill has programs that support conservation methods, and these are all voluntary. If you know that these techniques work and they're good for the environment, do you feel bad that they would make them mandatory? You would be against mandatory things.
Yeah, I always prefer that they be voluntary. You know, back to No-Till on the Plains, the organization I've been involved with for years, we've always helped to educate the farmers, and the organization very much by farmers for farmers. And that's always, as a farmer, that's kind of the approach I like, is that, you know, we help educate or teach, and certainly those programs through the government have been beneficial. I've utilized them to help with the learning process and to implement some of those.
Yeah.
So yeah, I prefer the voluntary. I'd rather educate the producer and let him believe and understand it rather than try and mandate or regulate that he has to do it.
Miriam, you think the markets here would decide?
Markets are playing a really critical role. We've got grocers ranging from Whole Foods to Walmart who are now putting signals into the market saying they want climate smart products to put on their shelves, and that makes an enormous difference. But that does really work in sync with some federal policy. You know, the land-grant universities and their extension services are completely critical and deserve to be far better funded in terms of providing critical research and then disseminating that research. There's also a lot of ways that things like crop insurance could be structured to really reward conservation. And now it actually gets in the way of some of these conservation practices.
And we're going to talk lots more in the year to come about farming and agriculture. So this is just the beginning of our conversation. I want to thank both of you for taking time to talk with us. Doug Palin, farmer and rancher from Glen Elder, Kansas, founding board member of the organization No-Till on the Plains. Where can we see that? Is there a website, No-Till on the Plains, Doug?
Yeah, you can just simply go to no-till, N-O-T-I-L-L.org, no-till.org.
No-till.org. Miriam Horn, author of the book Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. And there's a documentary based on the book on the Discovery Channel on August 17th. And you can read an excerpt on our website at sciencefriday.com/farmer. We'll take a break. We'll be right back to talk about the California drought. So stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. After 5 years of parched lawns, dry farm fields, The drought is over in California, thanks to just 2 months of heavy rains. The state has received more rain than the reservoirs can actually hold. Rivers are high. The snowpack is so deep that ski resorts are piled up to the tops of the chairlifts at some spots with the snow. It's not all frolicking in the water, though. Last month, for example, nearly 200,000 people were evacuated from below the Oroville Dam. You've seen that pictures of that spillage there. It was greatly damaged. And across the state, there are still torrential rains. They have fouled power lines, flooded roads, triggered mudslides. And is it right to say that the drought is over? I mean, what about recharging the aquifer? Do we need to do that? What can farmers count on for the dry summer months ahead? Governor Jerry Brown says he's waiting until April to make the call. But here to shine a light on where all that rain came from, where it may go, two researchers from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Bill Patzertz, climatologist, and Tom Painter, snow hydrologist and principal investigator for the Airborne Snow Observatory. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having us.
Bill, what's...
Happy Friday.
Hey, happy Friday to you. Bill, what's it been like to live in Southern California the last couple of months after so long a drought?
Well, after about 17 years of on and off drought, Ira, everybody's pretty giddy with all this snowpack and rainfall, but there are a couple of asterisks, as you mentioned. All the flooding has really caused over $600 million in damage to roads, bridges, and dams. But the bottom line, as sweet as this wet winter is, this is just a temporary fix. This is definitely no drought buster.
No drought, but when would you know? What will tell you that the drought is over? What do you need to see?
Well, you know, you have to go back. California, roughly a third of our water supply is snowpack, a third is imported water from the Colorado, and about a third is groundwater. And groundwater, which has been depleted severely over the past few years, will take years to replenish. And, of course, Lake Mead is precariously depleted. So simply, all this snow and rain is sweet, but we're still facing an ongoing water crisis here in the West.
So don't get too happy too soon is your message. Tom, I remember when you've been on the show before and you've gone out and surveyed the snowpack.
That's right.
What did you see this year as compared to years past?
Well, so we have seen an amazing amount of snow. We started our program in 2013. Some claim that we initiated the drought by starting to measure the snowpack with lasers. The most amount of snow that we've measured was just a month ago when we started flying again this year over the Sierra Nevada. There are many places where the snowpack is over 50 feet deep, that was a month ago. It snowed considerably since then. So the flights that we're doing today and over the next few days, we are pretty confident those are going to show areas with snow depths greater than 60 feet. I mean, it really is it's a profound snowfall accumulation and a transformation of the landscape, especially for what we've seen over the last few years. In terms of what Bill just mentioned, so the water usage, about 30% of that comes every year, 30 to 40% comes from snowmelt runoff. But what he didn't mention is that of the precipitation that falls onto the landscape of California and really across the western U.S., about 75 to 80% of that comes from snowfall. All right, so what gives with the difference? Well, the difference is what he mentioned. It's the pumping of groundwater and the import of water from other domains. But over the long haul, the replenishment of those groundwater supplies comes from what precipitation falls out of the sky. So over the long haul, you can't have that difference in ratios and have it be fully sustainable. So this is a fantastic year, and in terms of surface water, it's a great thing. The reservoirs are filling up. The groundwater in the surface layers is filling up, and so we should get really good runoff this year.
Mm-hmm. And so that would recharge the aquifers, you're hoping?
That's right. But it is a long process, and so it doesn't happen overnight. The overnight happens with respect to snowfall and rainfall at the surface, but getting into the deeper layers takes a long time. And we had in the month of January, with the big atmospheric river events that we had here, the whole of the Sierra Nevada, our best understanding of how much water fell out of the sky is about 25% more than the annual flow of the Colorado River.
Wow.
And that was just in two sizable atmospheric river events.
Well, let me ask both of you, what climate conditions will you have your eye on as the year unfolds to give you a better idea of what to expect water-wise?
Well, let me take this one. California climate is one of the most variable of any state. Historically, it swings from drought to flood to drought, but mostly drought. Not only that, the West is warming, and as it warms, more and more precipitation will fall as rain and not as snow, which will create tremendous problems in water storage. But in spite of all this, California is the sixth largest economy in the world, has a population of 40 million, a $60 billion agricultural industry. And California has a tremendous thirst, but a dry climate. So looking ahead, the key here will be water conservation by everyone, farmers, city dwellers, and industry. And so it's a warmer future, and it's a water conservation future.
There you have it. Let's go to the phones to Ron in Ventura County. Hi, Ron. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I was calling because I just wanted to mention that Western Ventura County is still in severe drought. I work with the Casitas Water District, and we're in stage 3. Our reservoir is only at 43% after 5 years of drought. One average rain isn't going to kind of get us out of it yet.
Hmm. That's interesting. So you're still under water restrictions?
Yes, absolutely.
And so all this rain we hear about didn't help you very much?
A lot of the rain went north and went south. So Lake Kachuma, which is in Santa Barbara County, and Lake Peru, which is also in Western Ventura County, have not fully recovered as a result of the rains. We were limited in what we received compared to the rest of the state.
All right, thanks for that update. Tom, how does rain in the mountains, you've been up there, how does that affect the snowpack that you've seen?
Well, in response to that and the caller's comment, I wanted to point out that in the northern Sierra Nevada, we're at about 80% of the value for this date for 1982-83, which is on record for being the largest year on record across that region and across California. In the central Sierra Nevada, we're just a little bit below that peak of 1982-83. And in the southern Sierra, we're right on track with that year. So as he mentioned, there is this spatial variability in the accumulation of the precipitation, and not only across the Sierra Nevada, but also in the lower lands of California. Now, in terms of rain, those are the snowpack measurements that I just described. But in 1982-83, it was a distinctly colder year, and so there was not very much rain that happened during the year. In this year, some of the early storms in the fall and then into December, January, had considerable amounts of rainfall as well. So the accumulation of precipitation, even though the snowpack reflects a certain number that is catching up with 1982-83, arguably there's been more precipitation than there was in that year, at least across the Sierra Nevada. Now, what happens with the rainfall in the mountains? As Bill was alluding to, as the rain-snow line increases in elevation, then more of that landscape is getting rain falling on it. And what happens with rain? It flows downhill. What happens with snow? It stays intact. And in staying intact there, it is a reservoir. So in the western U.S., what allows the civilization to exist with the kind of numbers that we have is that we have this dual reservoir system, well, actually three reservoir systems. One is the mountain snowpack, which has always been there. The other is the groundwater, which has always been there. And then the human-built reservoir systems that we rely on as well to modulate between those two. And so as more of that precipitation falls as rain, it runs off quickly and displaces reservoir capacity in the human-built reservoirs. So that works towards shrinking water supply. And as we saw this year, many of the reservoirs had to go into heavy releases of water to avert disaster, destruction of dams, massive flooding, et cetera.
All right. Well, thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Bill Patzert is a climatologist and Tom Painter, a snow hydrologist, principal investigator for the Airborne Snow Observatory, both out of NASA's JPL in Pasadena. Good luck to you, and thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome.
Been a pleasure.
Thank you. We want to now turn to the so what question of all of this, and that would be policy, water policy. What should we actually do with the data on how precipitation may be changing in the West? Do we need to replace those aging dams? Do we need to build more? KQED San Francisco water reporter Lauren Sommer joins me now. She's been following the conversations about how the state of California should manage its water. Welcome back, Lauren.
Hi, Ira.
Our last guests were in the L.A. area. What's the mood in the Bay Area been about all of this rain?
Yeah, I think shock is a fair word. I mean, we've spent 5 years hearing about we need to conserve, we need to cut back, about how dry it is. And there's just, I mean, as you've heard, this torrential amount of precipitation and snow and rain. And I think people are still reeling here.
Huh. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So you have a piece for KQED arguing essentially that the water system in California as it exists cannot handle California's changing precipitation patterns. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, we heard a little bit about this just now, that it's designed around the snowpack in the Sierra Nevada. It's like this big frozen reservoir. It keeps the snow and precipitation up there through the winter, and then it slowly melts kind of in the late spring down the rivers and feeds California throughout the summer, which is the dry period when we need it. As we've heard, more of that precipitation is going to fall as rain instead of snow. Well, that frozen reservoir is shrinking, and we have to catch more of that during the winter months. And that's where we're running into some problems right now. There's just so much water in the system that we're seeing, you know, reservoirs really hit their capacity. And downstream of the reservoirs, there are things like river channels and levees and flood infrastructure that's also been inundated. And we've seen a number of levees breach recently.
Yeah, well, we saw that famous Oroville Dam spillway. That was a disaster, I mean, from the way that water was rushing over. And I've had Californians tell me, when I bring up the subject of running out of water, they say, well, we don't have enough reservoirs. We need to build more reservoirs. And if we're having liquid water now instead of the snow, wouldn't that be an argument for that?
Yeah, it sounds like a simple question, right? But of course, yeah, it's not a simple answer. One basic thing that's happened over time, we've used all the really good places for dams in this state. There's just not a lot of places on these rivers where we can build big dam projects anymore. And the other thing that people really like to point out is that we talked a little bit about the groundwater. That's a vast storage area for water in this state. Some people say it's 10 times larger than all of our reservoir capacity. And so you're seeing experiments actually right now where people are taking some of these floodwaters, they're kind of spreading it out over farmland and cropland and letting it percolate back into the aquifers, because that's kind of a way to recharge some of these aquifers and keep the water stored there so we don't have to keep it in the reservoirs.
Mm-hmm. Why has this winter thrown such a spotlight on water policy? Is it just the flooding that's happening?
I mean, we kind of traded one crisis for another,
yeah.
Right? And everyone likes a good crisis.
Because we knew about the drought. Now you're hitting with just the opposite, right?
Yeah, and it's important to remember, you know, floods and droughts are not new for California, but some people are saying that this should be a wake-up call because climate change is expected to make the extremes more extreme in California. So droughts are still going to happen naturally, yeah. But if it's hotter, the droughts might be a little bit worse. And as in the winters, if the winters are a little warmer, we get less snow and more rain. So this is a natural cycle for California, but because we've seen these two events so close together, some people are saying, well, hey, California, we might need to really think about designing our water system for a future where we're going to see more of this extreme.
Well, can you read any of the political tea leaves about which way that might go? I mean, where the money would come from? And
that's always the challenge. And there is a very large backlog already in terms of things like levee maintenance and flood control infrastructure. So there's already some catch-up work to do. Here in the state, the voters of California passed a very large water bond back in 2014. And so some of that money still needs to be spent. And there's a big debate going on right now about whether that should go to large dam projects or things like groundwater recharge or just kind of shoring up the flood infrastructure throughout the state. So there definitely is a source of money there. Mm-hmm. It's not going to cover everything. And people are also waiting to hear what President Trump might do with his infrastructure spending. He's promised a lot of development that area.
Well, you know, as they say, so goes California, so goes the rest of the country. So we will be watching, all of us, out here to see how that works out. Thank you, Lauren. Thanks for your work.
Thanks.
Lauren Sommer, water, environment, and energy reporter for KQED in San Francisco. One last thing before we go. It's March, and you know what that means. Time for Mars Madness. Yes, that's right. I said Mars, as in the planet. You can find lots of red-hot stories, get it? Like why Mars is BYOB? That's bring your own bacteria. Why, if we go to Mars and settle it, we might want to bring our own bacteria. Great story up on our website at sciencefriday.com/Mars Madness. No bouncing balls involved. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. And you can email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. And you know where to find us online in social communities, up there on our website and in Facebook and Twitter. Science Friday's available all week long. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.